six of these today.
There's three.
Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our third case this morning is case number 70696, Neville versus District Court, reporting interest Terrible Herbs, Inc., Mr. Buck and Mr. Rusko.
Correct.
Mr. Buck?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Joshua Buck on behalf of Plaintiff Petitioner John Neville. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
For hundreds of years, Nevada employees have been able to seek unpaid wages in Nevada courts. Despite this, the District Court in this particular case held that plaintiff's wage claims should be dismissed on the grounds that the private right of action provided by NRS Section 608.140 and referred to in footnote 33 in this court's case in Baldonado, apply only to unpaid wage claims based upon the terms of employment and not unpaid wage claims based upon alleged violations of Nevada's labor claims. This is a distinction without a meaning. Labor laws are terms of employment. They are statutorily created by the Nevada legislature to restrict the control of the employment relationship in this state. Indeed, the simple definition of a term under the dictionary is a condition or an obligation imposed by authority. The legislature has enacted certain statutorily imposed conditions that are terms of employment relationships in this state. And indeed, in Baldonado, this court recognized that the labor laws were enacted for the purpose of protecting Nevada employees by regulating employers' control over certain terms of employment. By enacting the laws that are issued in this particular case, 608.016, 608.018, 608.020-050, the legislature has decided to impose terms and conditions on the employment relating to wages that should be paid for all the hours that are worked, that wages should be paid in excess of a certain number of hours, overtime wages, and that people should be paid within a certain amount of time when the employment relationship ends, and if they're not, they can collect a penalty. 608.040 recognizes this right, and indeed recognizes the right to recover wages and penalties. It's important that it refers to penalties at the end of that statute. And the reason is because these penalties it's referring to are statutorily imposed penalties. 608.040 was enacted in 1919. That provides that employees shall recover a penalty in the event that they are not paid pursuant to the conditions imposed under 020 and 030. These penalties that were enacted in 1919 are expressly referred to in the 1925 action statute in 608.140. So I submit that the plain terms of the statutory scheme reflect that employees may seek unpaid wages in court, and those unpaid wages include overtime wages, when someone works over 8 hours in a work day or over 40 hours in a particular work week. But even if the statute is maintains some ambiguity, and we are forced to go through our analysis as to what the legislative intent by looking like at the entire statutory scheme and what sort of results would come from that, I submit that it still provides that employees can seek unpaid wages in court in Nevada. And we can look to 608.150, for example, which is the action to recover wages from a prime contractor that this court addressed in U.S. Design. In U.S. Design, the court held that even though 608.150 does not expressly state that an employee can seek unpaid wages in court, rather it was a district attorney, the court said it doesn't expressly exclude that either. And what it did in that court is it also looked at other provisions, namely in the provision of the limitation of actions in Chapter 11, to reflect that there was indeed an intent to allow an employee to recover unpaid wages from the prime contractor. This case is will not be all that distinguishable from U.S. design in that respect. If you look at other statutory provisions, both in Chapter 608, namely 050, subsection 2, which provides an employee with a lien to be able to collect their unpaid wages, a lien is in and of itself a right for the employee to go to court to enforce an obligation. Okay? And then also, if we look at the other statutory provisions, particularly in NRS Section 607. In NRS Section 607-160, subsection 6 and 7, it refers to the Labor Commissioner and the Attorney General having an action in court for employees that they deem are unable to afford counsel. This is a striking a term in the statute itself.
So what do you do with Baldonado? Do you limit that to that particular statute, which says it's unlawful to take employees' tips, and say that statute alone does not have the right of private enforcement?
I think that's one way, Your Honor, but also, Justice Pickering, it's simply tips. Tips are completely different from wages. I mean, indeed, if you look at the definition of wage, it does not have any reference to a tip. And that's precisely what the California court did in Hawaiian Gardens. After this court ruled in Baldonado and referenced the California federal court case that said, no, tips might not be recoverable, the California Supreme Court agreed, essentially, with the analysis in Baldonado in a certain sense. It said that, no, tips are not wages. Therefore, they are not recoverable under the statute.
Counsel, there seems to be, from my standpoint, kind of an overread on Baldonado. In the case before us today, you put forth 608-140. That was not in play in Baldonado. The other comment, though, and the question is, there are some decisions from our federal district court that are going the other way. What's your take on those decisions?
Your Honor, I'm going to, if I may, particularly I'll deal with one case called Discutler, because that was frankly the first case that started to come up with this theory that somehow there's a distinction between contractually owed wages and statutorily owed wages. And I think that distinction is, like I said in my initial remarks, a red herring. I don't think that there is a real distinction there. And I think that as we submitted in supplemental briefing, when that was argued before the Ninth Circuit called it out as a red herring as well. When an employee goes to work for an employer, they can agree upon an hourly wage. Indeed, that's the definition of a wage. And if it's above the minimum wage, that's the term that they can agree upon. That doesn't mean that the employee isn't deserving and shouldn't have a right to be able to collect overtime on that particular wage in the event that they work over a certain number of hours in a work day or in a work week. But in addition to that, I think that what Discutler really falls short is the analysis that's using is not with the correct lens. We're talking about remedial statutes here that are supposed to be liberally construed to the benefit of the employee. Indeed, the declaration in NRS section 608.005 specifies that the Nevada legislature has intended to protect the health and welfare of Nevada's employees in relation to the terms and conditions of employment with respect to hours and compensation. And so what the Spectre is doing is, if you read that opinion, it will talk about the language in 601.140 and admittedly says it's a toss-up. If it's a toss-up, it must be construed in favor of the employee. And that is why those particular decisions, I think, Your Honor, are distinguishable. In addition, Your Honor, in Baldonado, it was not a 608.140 case, and that was recognized in the footnote fairly clearly in my respective opinion. Going back to in the event there is an ambiguity in whether or not you can collect unpaid wages, I want to focus on this one other step that we look at, which is the practical considerations. The practical considerations as to what would if you know, say you couldn't sue for unpaid wages, then what would happen? Here, we would have the untenable situation of numerous proceedings for the same factual allegations. You would have a claim for overtime that would have to go before the Labor Commissioner.
In the cases before us, in reading the material, Was there agreement that there was a mistake as to the failure to pay minimum wage, the dismissal of that count, and the only real counts in play are counts 2, 3, and 4, basically, as determination as to hour worked and overtime?
I think that the real party in interest has conceded that the minimum wage dismissal was an error. And so as of right now, the remaining issues are whether you can get overtime for wages that are worked when you work over 8 hours in a particular workday and over 40 hours in a work week. And here, if you look at the operative complaint that was indeed dismissed, that it's a fairly detailed complaint with exhibits attached that reflected the hours of work by Mr. Neville. And in that, it reflects that these hours work, at least according to the timesheets. And again, we're at the pleading stage, so we haven't had discovery, we haven't had all this vetted. But at the pleading stage, it shows that this individual is working upwards to 14 minutes a particular day for which he is not being compensated. And in this particular instance, those 14 minutes are over 8 hours a day. And because Mr. Neville is making less than the requisite 1.5 times the minimum wage, he is indeed owed daily overtime for those hours.
But the judge, the focus of the judge was on the fact that it was a jurisdictional issue, that all of these disputes were to go to the Labor Commission, despite what your individual arguments were.
Correct. I mean, the judge's opinion was, and is, that these particular claims, indeed, overtime claims and claims for all hours worked and the collection of penalties, Your Honor, under 020 to 050, have to all go to the Labor Commissioner and that they cannot proceed in court. And again, going to the practical considerations here, what we have is we have undeniably we're going to have a minimum wage claim go forward. And that minimum wage claim is going to be for the hours that Mr. Neville worked and he was not paid. And those hours are actually overtime hours. So now I have a situation where we're going to be able to get the minimum wage, or at least prosecute the claim in court for minimum wages, but now file a subsequent action with the Labor Commissioner to be able to collect the halftime on those wages. That doesn't make any sense. And I think that it doesn't make any sense. And in looking at 608.140, this court doesn't have to go there, because it's clear in 140 that employees have a right to be able to seek these unpaid wages and penalties in court. And by creating 608, by enacting 608.016 and 018 and 020 to 050, the legislature has indicated that employees have this right. I see that I have 3 more minutes remaining. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal if I may.
Thank you. For the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rick Ross Kelly. I'm here representing the real party in interest, Terrible Hurst. The issue before this court is really straightforward, and that is there an implied private right of action to sue for unpaid statutorily required wages and overtime compensation under NRS 608.016 and NRS 608.018? We submit that a review of the legislative history and the comprehensive administrative regulatory scheme devised by the legislature and suggests the answer to this question is no. Therefore, real party in interest requests that the court deny the petitioner's writ for 3 reasons. Number one, the plain language of the statutes in question do not provide for an express private cause of action. Number two, the Nevada legislature has clearly expressed and expressly provided that the enforcement of Nevada labor laws rests exclusively with the labor commissioner unless otherwise provided. In fact, that was one of the holdings of the Baldonado case also. And number three, NRS 608.050 and NRS 608.140, on which the petitioner relies for creating a private cause of action, do not create a private cause of action. They are simply respectively a mechanics lien statute and an attorney fee statute that recognize that common law there existed a right to sue for wages and contract. That is not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with statutory claims, as I will go into in more detail in just a minute here.
But what do you do with the body of law that says a contract embraces and carries with it applicable statutory law as well?
Good point. And the way I respond to that is twofold. Number one, what the statutory law does is it sets a minimum. It says you cannot contract. In fact, the minimum wage statute in Nevada says you cannot contract or abrogate the standards of this law by contract. You can't contract around it. So it sets a minimum requirement, number one. Number two, once the legislature occupies the field, that takes it outside the area of contract, you can't sue for contract for minimum wage. That's a statute. You have to sue for the statute, otherwise you'd have two competing remedies with different statutes of limitations and different implications. And so once the legislature legislates, it now becomes a statutory claim, which prohibits the party from contracting otherwise.
So are you conceding or not conceding that the first cause of action was in error?
We concede that because the minimum wage amendment clearly provides for a private right of action. It's, as I indicated, 608.050 and 140 clearly indicate that they are respectively a mechanics lien and a attorney fees in the contract area. In fact, this was basically the whole thing. Ms. Cutler analyzed the situation. Now, this is important because petitioner's complaint seeks to enforce a labor statute. In fact, if you look at their complaint, really, they're enforcing 608.016 because all of their claims in their case depend upon an interpretation of 608.016, which is simply a statute that prohibits a break-in period or training without compensation. They bootstrap that into a claim for off-the-clock work, and they have no cause of action unless they can prove that somehow the rounding policy implemented by my client, although it be facially neutral, contravenes the mandates of 608.016. Without that, they have no claim. Their minimum wage claim is derived from that. Their overtime claim is derived from that. Their off-the-clock claim is derived from that. So in reality, this is nothing more than an attempt to enforce 608.016.
Well, let me ask you this. If you're going to, looking at 608.140, it seems like we're just glossing over that. How do you reconcile that with what you're saying now?
Well,
608.140, whenever a mechanic, artisan, miner, laborer, servant, or employee shall have a cause to bring suit for wages earned and due, how does unpaid overtime not fit into that?
The way it doesn't fit into that is that we have to look, again, we're implying a private right of action. We know that the overtime statute does not have its own express private right of action. So under Baldonado, we have to take a look at what is the legislature's intent. That is the decisive factor in Baldonado. Here in 1925, there was no overtime. There was no minimum wage. There was no off-the-clock work. In fact, in Nevada, there was no minimum wage until 40 years later in 1965.
This is entirely wrong. For wages earned and due.
It is
what it is.
No, you're correct. It is broad in that regard, but in 1925, the only cause of action for wages was a cause sounding in contract. That's the decision and decisive point in Ms. Cutler. What they're saying is if we're going to be true to legislative intent, the legislative intent at this time was we're going to enforce statutory claims via the Labor Commissioner. In 1915, the Labor Commissioner's office was established. In 1915, the Labor Commission was tasked with enforcing all Nevada labor statutes unless otherwise provided. In 1919, timing statutes were passed. And in 1925, these wage recovery acts were passed, but the only cause of action was a common law cause of action for contract because the amount that you're paid and the basis for that pay, be it hourly, daily, or whatever, was all decided by private agreement. It wasn't until 1938, 13 years later, that the federal government adopted the Fair Labor Standards Act, which imposed for the first time a minimum wage. That's only the time when off-the-clock work became an issue because...
So tell me what 608.140 would apply to now.
It would apply to a claimant so that's not dealing with minimum wage or overtime. In other words, if I contracted with someone to pay them $50 an hour and I didn't pay them, I could be sued for contract. I certainly couldn't be sued for minimum wage. And so 140 would apply to that situation. But it doesn't
what about
apply.
The penalties?
They wouldn't be applicable either because that statute is only applicable to minimum wage, to contract claims.
Why would 140 even apply if you've got a contract? It's a contract.
Because the legislature has deemed in their wisdom that we're going to penalize someone who doesn't pay as they agree to pay. And that's what 140 says. If you don't pay according to the agreement you made with the employee, then we're going to penalize you. That's entirely separate from the minimum wage law passed in 1965, which is very instructive because when the legislature passed that minimum wage law in 1965, they could have easily said, hey, there's already a private right of action under 140 and 050, so we don't need to state there's a private right of action. We don't even need to provide for recovery of attorney fees, but they didn't do that. They specifically provided for a cause of action in civil court in the state of Nevada, and they set a statute of limitations of 2 years in the statute. The same thing happened in 2006 when the voters of the state passed by referendum the minimum wage amendment. They could have sat back if the petitioner's interpretation is correct and said, hey, there's already a statute of limitations, there's already a cause of action, there's already penalties, we don't need to do that. They didn't do that. Instead, what they did was they specifically made the minimum wage amendment enforceable. They imbued it with a private right of action, and they incorporated a statute of limitations, and they provided for an attorney fee statute that is different than the attorney fee statute in 140.
Mr. Roskelly, could you answer two questions for me along the point of your argument? First, when was 607-160 sub 7 added to the statutory scheme or placed as part of the statutory scheme for the labor commissioner? Secondly, does the language in that section, which contemplates some investigation by the labor commissioner to bring claims for wages, commissions, or other demands for those who are financially unable to do so, square with your argument that only wages can be asserted under 140?
You know, I don't have it on top of my head when those subsection 7 was added, so I can't respond to that, unfortunately. But the way that it plays into this is it makes perfect sense at the time. If the only claim that is enforceable is a contract claim, and the labor commissioner is charged with enforcing the statutory claims, the legislature gave the labor commissioner the right or the ability to represent individuals who could not pay for their own attorney to enforce a contract claim. Contrast that with...
So what you're suggesting in that argument, aren't you, is that the legislature purposefully intended to only allow the labor commissioner to prosecute claims for overtime, commissions, and other demands, not wages, for those who are financially unable to do so. So the rich could prosecute their own, but there were no statutory provisions for the labor commissioner to do so. That seems a bit of a stretch, don't you think?
No, I don't. It's only in the case of contract claims. The labor commissioner subsequently...
Wait a minute. 607-160, subsection 7, is not limited to contract claims. The language is pretty broad. It says that the labor commissioner believes that a person who is financially unable to employ counsel has a valid and enforceable claim for wages, commissions, or other demands. That seems to incorporate any claim that an employee can make against the employer for compensation of any form.
We have to read in the context of when it was passed.
Well, that's why I asked that question.
The statute itself, and I can't answer specifically subsection 7, but I believe subsection 7 was in there at the time. It was passed in 1915 or 1990. It was passed at the very inception, prior to there being anything other than a claim in contract. The first non-contractual claim was 1965 when the legislature changed and added the minimum wage amendment. So in that context, it makes perfect sense because we're dealing with private enforcement of private contracts. We'll allow the labor commissioner to decide if he's going to step in and help someone enforce a private contract, but we won't let him decide if we're enforcing statutory claims such as statutory minimum wage or the statutory minimum wage in that particular case, because even though he has the ability to defend those cases, the individuals have the right to bring those cases individually. But then NR 608 170 specifically mandates the labor commissioner, says that the labor commissioner shall enforce the labor laws in the state of Nevada. And 608-180 says the labor commissioner has to enforce the labor statutes from 050 to 195. And in 1975, the legislature passed 608-195, which specifically provided that it was a misdemeanor to violate the statutory requirements, and the labor commissioner could levy administrative fines at the same time.
So under 607, if I understand your view of today's labor scheme. Under 607, the labor commissioner can prosecute a claim for the kinds of claims that are being made by the plaintiff in this case for somebody who's financially unable to do so. But they can't do that for somebody who isn't financially able to do so because the statute limits the labor commissioner for those people to prosecute a claim for unpaid wages only.
What I'm saying is...
Is that your argument?
Not entirely close.
How does your argument differ from what I just articulated?
The petitioner is not asserting a contract claim. They're asserting a claim based entirely upon a statute, no matter how
you slice it. That's what I understand.
Right.
They're asserting a claim under the statute
right.
for unpaid wages, but in addition, overtime and off-the-clock claims.
Correct.
They're all statutory claims. That's
correct.
What I understand they're asserting.
And the labor commissioner is charged specifically with enforcing all the labor laws. Those are labor laws. They're enforceable by the labor commissioner. If it was strictly a
only for people who financially can't do so.
See, that's not the way I read the statute.
Well, then what's the purpose of those provisions?
Well,
what's the purpose of the distinctions being made in 607 that says only financially unable people? After investigation, the labor commissioner is going to pursue these claims. What about the other guys and ladies?
Because 607...
They have no claim at all?
607, 160, and 170 were passed in 1915 when only there was a right...
Well, right, but in the subsequent provisions adopted by the legislature, these were on the books, and the legislature knew that.
Yes, they did. The message of Baldonado is, in applying a private right of action, you've got to look back, because what was the legislature's intent? My point is really this. In 1925, when 050 and 140 were passed, the legislature could not have intended to be enforcing future labor statutes. We're creating a private right of action for future labor statutes that wouldn't exist for 40 to 60 years later.
So it's just the surplusage and these statutes are on the books and have no effect?
It has effect outside of that. I mean, it has an effect if you're dealing with a straightforward contract thing, right? Well, 140, now the fact that legislatures occupied a lot of the field, but certainly there are cases where someone's suing for something besides minimum wage and overtime. But for minimum wage, overtime, and off-the-clock work, those are statutory claims that by the terms of the scheme of Chapter 608 have to be enforced by the Labor Commission.
I guess I still don't understand your argument about 140. If you've got a contract claim, why do you need 140?
If you have a contract claim, you get penalties also. And you have 050, which is also a contract claim, because 050, they're simply recognized. Let me put it this way. They're recognizing a pre-existing right at common law to recover under a contract. They don't create a cause of action by themselves, but what they do is they provide tools in aid of that recovery. 140 and 040 provide a penalty that's attached.
Which is
it? Right, that can be recovered.
Yeah. I have one question, Brother. If I might. You said at one point in your argument that you think the off-the-clock work is neutral, but they attached to their complaint, this was decided at the pleading stage, Exhibit 1 to their complaint is this memo to employees about the 7-minute rule, which suggests that they were trying to always have it be rounded down rather than up. If it's at 7 minutes rather than 8 minutes, the 7 minutes gets rounded down, the 8 minutes would get rounded up. So don't they have enough to make their claim, at least at the pleading stage, that this policy was designed to, that it's in fact not neutral? Do you follow the question?
Yes, I understand the question. At the pleading stage, I would agree they have enough to make their case if there's a private right of action under one's
own. Yeah, right. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
Mr. Buck, rebuttal, 2 minutes and 54 seconds.
I may respond to Justice Hardesty's question. The statutes were indeed enacted in 1915, and the amendment with regard to representing folks who cannot afford counsel was amended in 1920. Before 1925, when the legislature passed 608.140, which recognized the right to sue for unpaid wages. And I think that your
issue with 607 is spot on in this particular case because you have instances where attorneys in this state are willing to take claims and represent them in a contingency fee agreement or an hourly fee agreement, whatever. They are able to take those claims and prosecute them in the courts. And the corollary is that if it is ruled that you have to go to the labor commissioner, then the labor commissioner's budget, staffing, and every other, would increase. And the labor commissioner has been repeatedly stated on the record, and we have supplied it actually in our lower court brief, a declaration from the former labor commissioner, who said it was the practice of the labor commissioner to not accept claims from individuals who could demonstrate that they could afford an attorney. And the reason was because they didn't have enough people to work the claim. So, individuals, for example, who may live in Elko or in the rurals, who can afford an attorney, would be required instead to go to a labor commissioner office in Carson City. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in terms of the statutory provisions that are issued here. And with that, I don't have
as the labor commissioner, I know that maybe this is just a side note, I apologize for the digression, but has the labor commissioner issued regulations that define financial responsibility as provided in 607?
From my understanding, the labor commissioner has only issued regulations to the extent that it specifically states in 607, NAC 607.095, I believe, that they will look into the financial condition of the claimant to determine whether to take jurisdiction over the claim.
Mr. Buck, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ruskell, and Mr. Buck, thank you for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until 1:30.